Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome to Stupidity, home of the greatest media mind ever to walk the planet.
Okay, so here's the deal. He's a true icon in every sense of the word.
He's loved and feared more than any being to grace this planet.
There's two guys, a man with a voice that sounds like Barry White and Beyonce had a Jewish baby.
God himself would pay $39.99 for a cameo. Fact of the matter is, you are about to embark on a transcendent experience that can only be described as psychological nudity.
This is Stu Gatz, and this is Stupidity.
Here we go, Jim.
Tony!
Billy, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Do I talk too much golf on Stupidity?
No. I mean, it's fine. Stupidity is kind of like your thing, and this is your outlet to talk golf. You can't do it much on the main show. I don't know, though. I mean, Mikey, what do you think?
I was just going to ask if you think he talks more golf on Stupidity or Jets on God Bless Football.
Wow, that is an interesting question.
Right, because you're sprinting away from the jet discussion, Mikey.
I don't judge. I'm just asking which one is more.
It's fair criticism. It is. And if you think I talk too much golf here, that's also fair criticism.
I mean, so the Jets, obviously you talk about Aaron Rodgers. You talk about the expectations leading up to the season. Then you talk about the Rodgers injury. And then obviously you have to talk about Kirk Cousins possibly going there because he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. They get two of those in the same season.
Right, of course.
Then they beat the Eagles and they almost beat the Chiefs. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're doing things to. It's not like we're talking about the Raiders every week, you know? Like, they're doing things.
Yes. I mean, the Jets are. They're in market number one. They're an interesting story. They, for the first time ever, Mike, our team is interesting, which is why I keep talking about it. But I keep talking about the Dolphins, too, because they're the best team in the NFL. So I'm just playing the hits, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the golf, I wonder if golf is a tune-out for most people. We're going to have Alan Shipnuck on. He's been on before. He wrote the book on Phil Mickelson. He's now writing a book about the merger between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf and how it all went down and how it happened. And he's great. I am fascinated by this stuff, but I have a feeling it's a tune-out for you, Billy.
No, I mean, okay. I'm open to it. Yeah, okay. I feel like I'm coming around. You know me, I'm a big golf guy. If you notice,
the clubs. Yeah,
the clubs. Well, the story behind that is the answer is they're right here, right off camera.
Oh.
I just moved them out of the shot because we had Raheem Mostert on earlier this week for God Bless Football later in the week.
Yes.
And the last time he was on, Stugatz pointed them out because they were being chummy, talking about golfing together and being good friends, the two of them. Right. And then they started making fun of the golf clubs that I had in the background, which really exist there because I don't have any other place to put them. And then Raheem Mostert was making fun of me. So when we had Raheem on again, I thought, you know what, I'm going to move these so that the golf clubs do not become a topic of discussion again. And then I simply forgot to put them back behind me for a book about golf. So I'm really killing it today.
I asked Billy earlier offline, Mikey, I asked him about the golf clubs, and he said those golf clubs are shitty. And I said, the golf clubs are fine, Billy. It's the guy who's using them that's shitty.
Well, you didn't say all that. You strongly implied it. Because he was talking about a golf outing.
Played once. I mean,
yeah, he's talking about a golf outing. I'm like, I mean, He's like, you're going to take your shitty golf clubs? And I'm like, are you going to take your golf clubs? I'm like, yeah, they're not the best golf clubs. He's like, it's not the golf clubs. I'm like, okay, unnecessary. Like, I get it.
I did. I've been back at you.
So unnecessary.
I'm sorry.
So buddy. I think you should play with those golf clubs.
They're not lefties. That's fine. Lefties,
I will. Billy will play with mine. I'm a lefty.
Yeah.
I'm a lefty. Billy's a righty. What are we going to – we can't do that.
I still don't understand that. Ones. I still don't understand that because you're not a lefty at everything.
So it's weird. I don't understand it either, to be quite honest with you. I am – any sport that involves a stick or a club, baseball, hockey, lacrosse, golf, I'm a lefty. Mm-hmm. But when I throw, I'm righty. I write with my right hand. I'm a strange guy, Billy.
Yeah, agreed.
In case you haven't noticed. Yeah. Yep. Are you excited for this, Alan Shipnuck? He's a great author. He's been on with us three times now.
I am excited. I'm also starting to like, so I'm piecing this together, Mikey. So we have the golfers on right after they win a big tournament because Stugatz wants to talk to them because they're winners. And then we have...
That's worked out, Billy, because Wyndham Clark we had on after he won like just a, you know, run-of-the-mill PGA event, and then he won the U.S. Open. So.
Yeah. Well, and we got him after that, too.
And we got him after that, right.
Yeah, but also, I'm starting to realize you're talking to the golf authors, so you don't have to read the book.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's a good strategy.
Yes. Tell me about your book. Yes. So I don't have to read it.
I mean, honestly, who has time to read nowadays? Like, for real. It's so like, I appreciate you guys coming on. I want to support what you're doing, but like... Sure. You want me to commit like hours and hours to sitting down and reading the book? Like if I have hours and hours, it's going to be doing something I want to do. It's not reading your book. Go get the book though. It's out now.
Thank you. He's been very good to us. He's a very nice guy. He's got a great head of hair. That has been a theme for Billy though. He feels like our show puts out too much content. He does. And he's right. I mean, well, who has time to listen to all this?
No, I told Stugatz, so I was in jury duty earlier this week. And I told him that I had an idea where I was just going to take notes on the entire episode and come in with notes the next day. And then I started that process and was like, oh, man, this is a lot. This is a lot of audio listening that I need to do. And my plan was to do it in the car drive on the way home from jury duty on the way into work. And I was like, they were long drives and I ran out of time.
And you would never listen in your house, right? Like, who does that?
It's not that I wouldn't. It's that I just like you. Mikey gets it. You got it at a time. There's just. When it's impossible,
yeah.
You
know?
There's not enough time. You're right, especially with where you guys are at in your lives right now.
There's a lot of walls that need to be stared at blankly before I can start doing things like that.
I wish I had wall staring time. Honestly, I miss it.
How much would you pay just to stare at a wall the entire day?
A good wall stare. So you want to know something funny?
A good wall stare.
You want to know something funny? So like. We work with different people, and one of the people that we work with helps us with guests. So, like, yesterday, she was reaching out and asking me, like, making suggestions, like, would you take this person? Would you take that person? And I, like, text her back. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry that I haven't really gotten back to you today. I'm in jury duty, so, like, I got to check it a little later, and I'll get back to you. To which she replied, oh, wow, you have jury duty on top of everything else you have going on. She goes, honestly, jury duty sounds like it's probably, like, a nice break for you. And I thought about it. I'm like, you know what? It was a really slow day. Maybe I should have tried harder to get on a jury. I should have just chilled there for like 4 days, just sit there in the AC listening to a case, you know? Yeah. Not a care in the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
Free lunch brought to you? Yup.
Yeah.
You don't have to deal with your kids. You don't have to deal with your dogs, your wife. Most importantly, you don't have to deal with me.
So I had a crazy, it was like 6 or 7 months after my first daughter was born. And I had a kidney stone and I got like admitted to the hospital because they needed
so
to put like painkillers and all this stuff. Right.
Yeah.
It's not the first time that I've had it, but I got admitted and I was there and like, you know, my daughter's just a baby and my mom was there at the beginning. And then I told her like, just, you know, go home. Why are you going to stay with me in the hospital overnight? And like, whatever, I'll figure it out. So I stayed alone at the hospital, like going through the kidney stone. Cause I just sent everybody home. Great night of sleep. I mean, it was probably the Toradol and everything that they had like pumped into me, but like, man, I always thought like being alone in the hospital would be like really depressing and terrible. And even though I was there, I was like sad. I'm like, but man, I got a good like 4 straight hours. This is great.
Are you rooting for another kidney stone?
I'm drinking soda. I'm not drinking water. I'm doing everything. Red meat. I'm just like in it, like not even cooking the meat. Cook me up some stones. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Let's get to Alan Shipnuck. I love you, Billy. Stu Gatz here for my friends over at Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years. One thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So, what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. For me, it is simple. What I want out of my light beer is ice cold and great taste, and that's exactly what I get from the original light beer, Miller Lite. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most, a light beer that tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Stu, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Alan Shipnuck going to join us. He is a great author. He's a regular on the show. He has a new book out, Live and Let Die, The Inside Story of the War Between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. What's going on, Alan?
I'm delighted I've been upgraded to regular. Thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
I mean, it's your third. Stop writing books and we won't bring you on anymore. I mean, enough.
This will be a lively conversation. I'm here to answer any questions. Fire away.
Why'd you write the book? Let's start there.
I think this is the biggest golf story of the century. You know, certainly non-Tiger Woods division, and it's an incredible mix. You have these blockbuster protagonists. I mean, every golfer who's mattered over the last quarter century, including Tiger and Phil, but obviously Rory and Bryson and Brooks and Dustin. And then you have Donald Trump, you have Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. You have this guy, Yasir Al-Rumayyan, who now runs professional golf to some degree. So just this incredible cast. And then you've got these like big Shakespearean themes around, you know, greed and betrayal and vengeance and legacy and loyalty. I mean, stuff transcends golf, transcends sports. I mean, it's really such a human story. And then these incredibly complex geopolitical questions around the Saudi money and sports washing and all this playing out in real time. I mean, it was a fascinating project. I learned so much about so much. And I've been obsessively followed this story. And I don't think anyone else could bring that level of attention. So I feel like I'm kind of a tour guide for fans who know part of it, or they've tuned in here and there, but they want to know more and they want to really know the inside tale of what actually happened, because there's been so much spin and there's been so much propaganda. So, hopefully I succeeded just bringing it all together in one place, and it's educational, but more importantly, it's entertaining.
I have a two-parter here. So one, how surprised were you, I guess, when there was a merger of sorts? And two, do you wish it would have happened after the book came out?
No, I'm delighted it happened when it did, because if the book had gone to print and then this came down, I would have been devastated. You know, it would have been a gaping hole in the story. And people said, well, how can you put the book out now? We don't know how it ends, but I would argue that we do. I mean, there's only three possibilities. Like, either this framework agreement will get consummated, it'll blow up, or what's emerging is the most likely scenario, where the Saudis bring in some other outside investors, come in, private equity, and the Saudi stake is diluted a little bit in their influence. And that makes it more palatable for the public, for the players, and for Congress, most importantly. So, but I lay out all three scenarios in the last chapter, and I think I'm covered come what may. But the original final chapter before all this stuff happened, right, as you know, at the end of the timeline, was that I was kind of forecasting how it could play out. And I did anticipate a quote unquote merger, but I thought it was going to take a lot longer. Like, the speed and the secrecy was kind of stunning, but golf has to come back together. There's not enough stars to support even one tour, let alone two. And to try and reintegrate all the top players into the big events is really important for the sport. And so it makes sense to try and put it back together, but it's impressive the way, I mean, the PGA Tour is not good at a lot of things, but they're really good at keeping a secret, apparently, because even their top players didn't know this was happening. So it was definitely a thunderbolt, but I am happy that I was able to write about it and report on it and bring some insight and analysis to it.
Alan, can you tell us the details around how the idea for the LIV Tour was hatched?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this book's like the biography of an idea, because this whole thing started, this one nerdy golf fan in London named Andy Gardner. He's a lawyer. He watches a lot of golf, and he just, like probably a lot of us, felt like had gotten a little tired and a little bloated and that it needed to be refreshed. And so he was pretty well-connected guy. Excuse me. He started talking to stakeholders in the game, including Rory McIlroy and Keith Pelley of the European Tour. And he started filling up these, you know, yellow legal tablets with his ideas. And ultimately, this led to the birth of the Premier Golf League, which was a reimagination of the professional game. But Andy Gardner was an idealist. He was not a closer. He could never quite launch it. He never had enough money to lure the players or to get the Premier Golf League. But he did bring in the Saudis as investors. That was one of their footholds in professional golf. And they pledged $500 million. But when the Premier Golf League failed to launch, the Saudis realized, we don't need this guy. We can do it ourselves. And they basically just cut and pasted his entire idea and put all their resources and created LIV Golf. But it's incredible that the sport has been shaped so much by basically an outsider with a dream. And he didn't get it across the finish line, but he was the spark.
Well, why did the PGA, was there anything the PGA Tour could have done to prevent this from happening?
Yeah, I mean, Gardner tried to forge a partnership with the PGA Tour to bring the PGL events under the banner of the PGA Tour, kind of a tour within a tour. And he put a full court press on Rory because he was now part of the board of directors, and he was trying to get a meeting with Jay Monahan. Monahan would not take the meeting. Like, he just didn't want to give any oxygen to this potential competitor. It worked. He was able to kill the PGL. But he tried the same playbook with the Saudis, but they had the money and the resolve to get it done. And so it's one of the kind of emotional high points of the book, I think, is when the Saudis break from the PGL, they decide they're gonna try and get into professional golf in a huge way on their own. Their number two guy, his name is Majed Al Saror, he sends a letter to Jay Monahan saying, we want to partner with the tour, we want to invest in the tour. And he sends us, and Monahan, he refuses to even pick up the phone and talk to this guy. And then he won't even give the letter or the details to his full board of directors. Finally, one of the player directors says, why are we not talking to the Saudi guys? It was Charlie Hoffman. And Monahan says, we do not negotiate with someone who's trying to ruin the PGA Tour. Like, we are at war. We are at war, at war, at war. And he said this in a board meeting. You know, no one's ever known about this letter or about all the stuff that happened behind the scenes. And that was like my mandate for the book, was to bring this stuff that all happened in secret and bring it out into the sunlight for fans and other stakeholders to understand how we got to this moment. And that's a foundational part of the story, is Monahan's refusal. And of course, He goes on to demonize the Saudis and their money and make this a moral argument. He brings the 9/11 families into the conversation. But ultimately, the tour runs out of money and he has to go with his tail between his legs to try and forge a compromise. And if you gave Jay Monahan a time machine, I'm sure when that letter lands on his desk with a thud, that he would pick up the phone and make the phone call. Because whether it was hubris, whether it was bad business acumen, whether he overrated the value of the PGA Tour to its players, he made the wrong call at a critical moment.
How and when did Greg Norman get involved?
I mean, it starts in the 90s when Norman had this idea for a world tour that was going to be a competitor to the PGA Tour. And he got a fellow Australian iconoclast, Rupert Murdoch, to fund it. And Norman, his fatal mistake was he didn't talk to the tour. He didn't talk to other players. He kind of acted unilaterally. And the backlash was so severe that Norman became a pariah in the game. You know, the PGA Tour commissioner, Tim Fincham, killed the idea, and then he stole it. Once again, history repeats itself, and he created the World Golf Championships, and he just flat out stole the idea. And Norman has been embittered ever since, and he's nursed this grudge against the tour. He's never let go of this idea that golf should be more global, which is probably a good idea, and he's probably right on the merits. But he finally found someone to buy into the vision. And it was these Saudis who were, kind of blinded by his star power and his charisma. And they didn't really, I think, fully understand, because they were outsiders, that how toxic Greg Norman is. And by making him the head of LIV Golf, in some ways, that was an act of war against the establishment. And that helped perpetuate the bitterness and the divides. But yeah, so Norman's had this idea, going back to the early 90s. It's incredible that it's finally happening.
It's fascinating. Alan Shipnuck is with us. New book is out, Live and Let Die, the inside story of the war between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. You spoke to so many fascinating people who are involved in this story, and so I'm asking you for the medal stand of shocking things that you discovered while you were putting this book together. Bronze, silver, gold, like just shocking things you found out as you were putting this thing together.
That's a thought-provoking question. There's the Mickelson biography. There's probably not an earthquake on par with, his quote about the scary mofos and all that. Like that was a thunderbolt. I would say
that's your gold is what you're saying.
I'm saying that's a high standard. The gold for this book, I think gold has to be what we were talking about with Monahan, the letter, the board meeting.
Yes.
This declaration of war. And so, that would be number one. The silver medal, I think it has to be, and it's hard to pick out one. I would just say the complexity of the characters throughout this whole book, because there's not a lot of like black and white, good guy, bad guy. It's much more nuanced. And so Jay Monahan, for all his mistakes, he did lead the tour through COVID masterfully, and he did kill the PGL, and he has gotten his players a 2 or 3 times raise, which is his mandate. So is he the hero or the villain? I mean, he's kind of both. Same with Norman. This guy Yasir Al-Rumayyan, he would make a great bad guy. He's kind of this shadowy figure from the other side of the world. He's got all the money and all the power, but he does love golf. He believes in golf. He's a purist. Like his as an ambassador for the sport, as a missionary, he believes in what he's selling. Like it can be a vehicle to create relationships and to change societies. And so I guess the silver medal is all these guys who pop in and out of the story who are more three-dimensional than we presumed, and their motivations are more interesting. And it's not just greed. Like it's been very easy to dismiss the LIV players and say they just sold out and took the money. Obviously that's true on some level, like the money was the inducement, but like Bryson DeChambeau told me, and there was like actual pain in his voice, 6 years in a row, he tried to get elected to the Player Advisory Council on the PGA Tour, and which is really a nothing organization. It has no power, but it's like running for office in junior high. It's a popularity contest. Right. He wanted to be ASB president, and 6 years in a row, his peers rejected him. And he's like, I guess they just don't like me and they don't like my ideas. Like, he was wounded. He had to go to live golf to be, to have a voice and to have a leadership position and to be validated. And so obviously the money was a factor. No one's going to say that's not true, but there was more in play there. And I mean, those are 10 different examples, but the silver medal is, yes, is the, it's the humanity.
Right.
I mean, the bronze, there's so many things in this book that make me laugh.
Well, give me one of those. That's what I'm looking for. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, here, let me call this up because I can find the text. It's, okay. You know, Paul Casey, who was an ambassador for UNICEF, mm-hmm, and he refused to go play in the Saudi tournament for years because he felt, you know, he talked about the kids in Yemen from the bombing who were starving and all this and that. And it was a very principled stance. And then he goes to live golf and like completely tosses all that stuff aside. And naturally he came up for some criticism and he was defensive about it. So at the British Open in 2022, it's his first tournament since he went to live golf, where he's kind of back in mixing with players from other tours. And Jamie Weir, who's become a source of some intrigue in the golf media, he goes up, he's a Sky Sports reporter. He goes up to ask Casey if he can do an interview. And, you know, Casey is immediately on the defensive. And he says, what do you want to ask me about? And Weir says, well, you know, talk about, it's the Open, how's your back feeling? And I'll end with like a live question. And, you know, Casey says, you know, when he hears it's going to be about live. So this is from the book. I'm going to read this part because it's so funny.
Okay.
This is Jamie Weir speaking. He says, his face darkened. He said, fuck off. Go fuck yourself. What a fucking shit question. Go fuck yourself. That's a shitty fucking question from a shitty fucking reporter. And I said, Paul, you're massively overreacting to this. He was like, no, I'm not. Go fuck yourself. Fuck you. And fuck your interview. This is a golf book. And then, so I call up Casey, you know, after I've heard this from Jamie Weir, because of course I needed to get his side of the story. And so Casey says, that's a fairly accurate recounting. But what is missing is the fact he sauntered over, invaded my space, and interjected himself into an environment where he was not invited. What he actually said was, this is probably going to be the last major championship you ever play. He's just assuming I'm going to fail. I could have won that Open and have been exempt for another 25 years. I was there grinding on my game, and it was his smugness that got me. I can debate with anybody, but he was just being a dickhead. You know what? Jamie Weir can go fuck himself again.
That's the gold medal right there.
I mean, it's so unbelievably funny, but what it speaks to is the energy around this story, the bitterness, just the raw emotion,
even the embarrassments, you know,
the embarrassment, the, you know, Paul Casey, his legacy is at stake, right? Like, he's spent 20 years winning golf tournaments around the world. He's always conducted himself as a gentleman. I think he's a mostly liked figure in the sport. He goes to live and all of a sudden he knows that everyone's pounding him and he just snaps. He just totally loses his mind. It tells you how deep this ran and how personal it was. This wasn't just a business story. It wasn't just a golf story. I mean, this is about like humanity. And it's funny, but it's also poignant because that's how much was bottled up inside of him. And everybody went to live.
I want to give Weir a golf clap just for pissing off Casey that much. That is outstanding work by him, man.
I mean, and you know, honestly, like, I've been on the receiving end of that. Even like earlier this, you know, last week, Justin Thomas came at me on Twitter, and, you know, his critique, you know, he said, I'm sick of Alan Shipnuck, like, not writing more positive things about golf. It's like, it's such an eye roll. We are in the middle of the most contentious period in the history of the sport. And it is not my role to whitewash it. And I'm not a publicist. I'm a reporter. And, you know, my job in this book, I wasn't pro live, I wasn't pro tour. Like, I played it down the middle. It was just to tell the story completely accurately and fairly about what really happened. And, you know, for Justin to be so bent out of shape because I'm not parroting the official version of the PGA Tour and I'm not celebrating, you know, these guys who've screwed a lot of things up, like, it's very revealing. And You know, he also in that tweet, he said something about, you know, I'm sick of Alan Shipnuck making money, you know, writing stories. It's like, he's going to make more money finishing dead last at a no cut elevated tournament, which only exists because of LIV Golf, right, than anyone on the golf beat's going to make this year. But the pros have gotten so greedy. They're so voracious. It's never enough. And that's part of this story too. I mean, it traces this corrosive effect of money that came into the sport in a way, unparalleled amounts. And it became like this x-ray machine of the soul for a lot of these guys. And it didn't reflect well on a lot of them. And again, it's not my role to whitewash that. Like, this is who they are. These are the choices they made. And so that Justin's so bent out of shape that I'm trying to do my job, I thought, said more about him than about me, honestly.
Who turned down the most amount of money?
Well, Hideki Matsuyama. He would have been the highest paid player on LIV Golf, because even before LIV launched, Norman had ID'd him as their primary target, because the thinking was, if you get Hideki, you get the entire Asian market, and you would get all these blue chip companies to be sponsors. And so he was offered over $300 million and he turned it down. So he's the clear answer. But then you could also say Tiger. It never even got to the point of an official offer because he had made his disdain clear. But what's interesting is they were going to give him his own franchise on LIV. Like, you know, there's these other captains like Phil and Bryson Brooks. They have 25% equity in those teams. They're going to give Tiger 100% of the team, but they're also going to give him equity in LIV itself, as an enterprise that potentially can create a lot of revenue. And so, you know, one of the executives who was part of the negotiations told me, like, there's a lot of goats who buy a franchise, you know, whether it's Derek Jeter or now it's Tom Brady, but we're going to make him the goat of all goats, and he was going to own part of the league itself. You know, like, that's unheard of. So it's hard to put a value on what that could have been worth, but, you know, their ultimate goal is to sell these franchises for $500 million. I mean, you could come, you know, Norman said it was high nine figures. That's probably optimistic because it's a lot of speculative money, but no doubt it would have been a windfall for Tiger potentially. So those are the two answers. But, you know, a lot of guys turned down a lot of money. Ricky Fowler turned down $75 million. So did Jesus. Patrick Cantlay. You know, Fowler's near the end of his career. He won once, and it's been like this renaissance. But now he's got to do it again and again and again to even ever sniff anything close to that. And then, you know, Cantlay's become this lightning rod because he's on the board of directors, and he's known to be a divisive force in trying to get this framework agreement consummated. And when you know you turned down $75 million, now you understand why he's so salty about the whole right. thing. So yep. A lot of guys turned down a lot of money.
Live and Let Die is out right now. The inside story of the war between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Alan Shipnuck, the author, is joining us. So many fascinating names that are involved in this. So I'm just going to say a name and you tell me what their role was in this whole LIV PGA Tour thing. Okay. Donald Trump.
I mean, it goes back. Chapter 5 of this book, I trace the history of Saudi Arabia going back to when the oil was discovered in 1938. And the road to 9/11, the rise of MBS, the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. It's like, what is this doing in a golf book? But it's so germane to why they are investing billions of dollars into sports washing their reputation through golf, because they've, as Phil accurately said, you know, MBS is a scary motherfucker, and they're trying to cleanse his reputation for the Western world. And after Khashoggi was killed, the only ally that MBS had in global politics was the president of the United States, Donald Trump, and he helped keep him in power. And he said to Bob Woodward, like, I saved his ass. Like, Trump knew it. And now Trump is hosting these LIV golf events, being paid millions of dollars by the Public Investment Fund. And on some level, it's a thank you for his advocacy. And it's the Trump LIV nexus has been very problematic for LIV. You know, the first event at Bedminster, he had that MAGA rally where he had Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and that really damaged LIV in the marketplace, because big brands are apolitical. They don't want any controversy. And so LIV was out there trying to cut deals with all these blue chip corporations. They saw that and they all ran for the hills. And, you know, three of the events this year on the LIV schedule are at Trump properties. Like, he's an integral part of what LIV Golf has been. And so he's just a complicating factor in all of it.
Yeah, one of those is in Miami this week. So that's that's kind of interesting at Trump Doral. Jack Nicklaus.
I mean, it's kind of funny because Jack Nicklaus wound up suing himself, and Saudi money was in the center of it. You know, he sold 51% of his interest in the Jack Nicklaus companies, and the company wound up suing the man himself. And the centerpiece of the whole lawsuit was that Jack wanted to take the Saudi money and become part of the LIV leadership as his figurehead. And the company had to talk him out of it because it would have damaged their brand so much. And then Jack wound up countersuing for slander for some of the statements that were made around this. And again, it's like, and Jack is also close friends with Donald Trump. He famously endorsed him in the 2020 presidential election. And I'm sorry, 2016. And so it's just been, it's been a very messy late period in Jack's life. I mean, he's 80 something years old. He should just be this grand old man of the game. But the Saudi money, the Saudi influence has even besmirched Jack Nicklaus. And it's been fascinating to unwind all that in the book.
How much money was he looking to get?
Yeah. Well, so that's disputed. Jack himself said they had offered him $100 million to basically have the Greg Norman role, which doesn't really track, because at 82 years old, is Jack going to go to 14 events around the world and be part of every business meeting and every Zoom call? Like, obviously not. The LIV guys told me they were going to create a more ceremonial position. Like, they're talking about the Jack Nicklaus trophy that would go to, you know, the individual champion on their points race every year. And what was interesting about this reporting this book is everyone was always spinning me and telling me things that didn't check out. And so they had the crux of the lawsuit is this meeting that happened in Florida between the LIV people and Jack and his associates. And what was said and what happened is the centerpiece of this lawsuit. And so after months of cajoling, begging, threatening, I finally got two people to talk to me. One was a LIV Golf executive who was there in the room. The other was one of Jack's inner circle. He was there in the room too. And their description of what happened were polar opposites. It was like they were not even in the same place at the same time. And it tells you how much bullshit is floating around. So I wasn't in the room. I don't know what happened. I couldn't get anyone else there to talk to me. So what's the truth? It's unknowable from my perspective. So what I did is I just printed back to back the statements from both parties and let the reader kind of decide who they really believe. And there might be a little shadowing of some of the words and the setup. Like, I might have tipped my hand slightly, but you know, ultimately that was one of the great challenges in this, is that there was like this information war that was playing out in this saga, certainly on social media, definitely in press conferences, without a doubt, and all these private chats between Jay Monahan and his players. And so that was the challenge, was to constantly cut through all that and get to the heart of the story and tell it in a complete and accurate way.
Dustin and Paulina Johnson. Like, how?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Dustin is a crucial piece in all this. He was the only blue chip player who signed up for the first LIV event. And it was because
it's when I knew it was real, Alan, is when Dustin signed up for it.
1,000,000%. Yeah. And if they hadn't gotten him, it could have folded overnight because they had nobody else.
Right.
Dustin gave it credibility, and he's the reason why the next week Bryson and Patrick Reed signed on, and he's the reason why Taylor Gooch went as well. Like, and those are in some ways the three most important players, because they're in their primes, you know, Gooch, Reed, and Bryson. Like, they were risking a lot to give up on the PGA Tour. And so, you know, Dustin was crucial in the launch of LIV, and he's been, in his own way, he's been a great ambassador for LIV, because everyone likes Dustin. He has not talked any shit to the other players. He did not participate in the lawsuits. He just kept his mouth closed and cashed the checks. And I think that helped, you know, simmer things down. You had, you know, Phil's been very uppity. Lee Westwood, Ian Poulter, they've been chirpy. But, you know, Dustin kind of stayed above the fray and is like, okay, well, I can't totally hate LIV because I like Dustin. I like watching him play, and he's not a bad dude. So he's meant a lot to LIV Golf.
All right, last two, and we'll let you go here. Rory.
Yeah, Rory's a fascinating character in this book. I mean, he's certainly been celebrated as, you know, the conscience of golf and as this kind of this white knight. for the PGA Tour, and he has put himself on the line, but he's also been a troll throughout this whole thing. He's taken a lot of personal shots, and it's funny when, you know, this war of words he's had with Greg Norman, you know, I laid out in the book, it starts over some pithy text messages. Like he went on this global campaign to discredit Norman, basically because Norman sent him a text he didn't like. Like it shows you how like thin skinned and petty these guys can be.
Crazy.
But you know, Rory's kind of a tragic figure in this because he was an idealist and he put his heart on the line to try and defend the tour. And then the money guys came in, the Jimmy Dunns and these cold-blooded boardroom warriors, and they ripped open Rory's chest cavity and they tore out his heart and they stomped on it in soft spikes. And it was hard to see it happen in real time. And, you know, Rory's become pretty disillusioned by the whole thing. And I think he's going to pull back from public advocacy and from any kind of governance stuff. And maybe that's good for him. He'll just focus on winning golf tournaments because he got really sidetracked in this whole kind of war of words.
All right. So that was the last name for me, because this person, he's been on my podcast and I know him, and this is fascinating. Jimmy Dunn, because for so many different reasons, him and Rory were really, really close. I don't know if they still are, but they were really close, played golf together all the time. So explain to the audience who Jimmy is. He's a board member at Augusta. He runs Seminole, and how he was involved in all this.
Yeah, he's a mythical figure in golf world. Reputed to be the first guy to become a member simultaneously at Augusta National, Pine Valley, Seminole, and Cypress Point. Those are the four leading clubs in America. And so if you're going to be a member at all of them, like, he's just a beloved figure in the golf world. And he's a legend in the business world too. You know, he's done everything you can do, and he's made all the money, and he's given it all to charity. And
it should also be pointed out that his business was deeply impacted by 9/11. So
I was just going to go there. So yeah. So Sandler O'Neill, they had an office on like the 120th floor of one of the towers. And I think of the 83 employees, like 69 died on 9/11. And Jimmy Dunn, put all the kids who lost a parent, paid for all their college. They paid the salaries of every employee who was lost for 10 years. Like 9/11 affected him on a very fundamental level. And by the way, golf saved his life, because instead of being in the office that day, he was trying to qualify for the US Mid-Am. Like he was out playing golf, and otherwise he would have been in that tower too. And right. So he was brought onto the board in November 2022 to help forge this armistice, because he has unique people skills and ability to move in these very rarefied circles. And he's the guy who salvaged this whole truce from the tour's perspective, but it came at tremendous personal cost. Not only is he close friends with Rory, like he got Rory's dad, a former bartender, into Seminole. Like that's, you know, that's for the ruling class. That's the inner sanctum. They don't have like old bartenders there. And it speaks on some level to Jimmy Dunn's credibility. Like he has his fiduciary duty as a board member to do what's best for the tour, and they had to cut this deal even though it was going to come at tremendous personal cost to him, and he still did it. But because he's been so outspoken about 9/11, it put him in this very delicate position where he had to defend this deal, this partnership with the Saudis. And he went on this golf channel and he kind of cracked. You know, I think the pressure got to him, and he said, you know, because he was asked about partnering with the Saudis, and he said, these guys have nothing to do with 9/11, but if I find anyone who did, I'll kill them myself.
Right.
And it was just like exploded out of him. And it tells you how deep these passions are and the cognitive dissonance of so many people in this story, where there was so much going on and they were so conflicted. And that's why it's such an incredible human story, because it's not just about golf. It's about these big themes. You know, Jimmy Dunn got caught up in the middle of all of it, as did pretty much everybody in golf. And this story touched everyone, and to peel back the layers and to tell it, you know, in one place was an almighty challenge, but it was also like a heck of a lot of fun.
I can't imagine Jimmy wanted to do this. In fact, I'm guessing he did not want to do this, but he had in his mind, he was saving the PGA Tour, correct?
Yeah, he doesn't. Listen, the last thing Jimmy Dunn needs is all this hassle,
right,
and all this controversy, yes, and get hauled in front of Congress to testify. Like, he could be out there playing golf at, you know, at Cypress Point. That's a lot more pleasant.
Jimmy Dunn could start his own tour if he wanted to.
Exactly. So
right.
It does. Like, he's a principled guy. And that, I think part of why this book is interesting is because these, the the protagonists are so nuanced. And so there's so much to unpack with Jimmy Dunn. And I had fun telling stories about who he is and why he's so revered. And the average golf fan never heard of Jimmy Dunn until recently. And so now he's an important part of the story. Every time someone pops into the narrative in a meaningful way, you get the backstory. So you understand their motivations and their conflicts and the tension in their lives. And Jimmy's a fascinating character.
Check out the book. It's out now. Live and Let Die, the inside story of the war between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. Alan Shipnuck, the author, kind enough to spend the last, 40 minutes with us. It's a fascinating story. Great work by you as always. And we appreciate it. And by the way, tell Justin Thomas to get over himself, okay? Go win a Ryder Cup or something.
You said it, not me, but cosign. Yeah.
All right, man. Hey, we appreciate it. Good luck with the book. I'm certain it will do well. It's a fascinating fucking story, man. The PGA Tour and LIV merging and Jimmy Dunn being at the center of all of this. Fascinating stuff. We appreciate the time, man.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Stu Gatz here for my friends over at Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years. One thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So, what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. For me, it is simple. What I want out of my light beer is ice cold and great taste, and that's exactly what I get from the original light beer, Miller Lite. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most, a light beer that tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Stu, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text THIN to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text THIN to 200-300. That's THIN to 200-300. THIN to 200-300.